is busting out all over.
Hey, hey, sex fans, welcome back. June is indeed busting out all over, and that can mean only one thing here at DrDickSexAdvice.com. It's LGBT Pride Month. Hooray! To kick off our celebration, we're going to take an audio field trip to the land down under to visit with one of the most interesting men I've had the pleasure of meeting. And seeing this is the Sex Wisdom Show, you can be certain that my guest is among the movers and shakers in the field of human sexuality. Because this is the series where we meet researchers, educators, clinicians, pundits, and philosophers who are helping us take a fresh look at our sexual selves. My guest is none other than Benjamin Law, the author of the critically acclaimed book Geisha, Adventures in the Queer East. Benjamin is a journalist, columnist, and screenwriter, and he has a PhD in television writing and cultural studies, don't you know? His passion is evident in all that he does, but he's also funny as all get out. I can't wait for you to meet him. But before we get to all of that, a word from our sponsor, Dr. Dick's Stockroom. You'll find this treasure trove of sexually stimulating toys, implements, and fetish wear and gear right there on the front page of DrDickSexAdvice.com. Look for the Dr. Dick's Stockroom banner in the sidebar of my site. You'll surely enjoy shopping at Dr. Dick's Stockroom because it's just so damn fun. And, I might add, easy. Yes, sirree, sex fans, you can spare yourself the embarrassment of skulking down to your local sex emporium to pick up all those nasty toys you've been drooling over. You can forget about seedy storefronts in unsavory neighborhoods, and you don't have to worry about leering salesmen scrutinizing what you buy. Why? Because you shop from the privacy of your own computer. That's why. Thanks to Dr. Dick's Stockroom, it's never been easier, or more discreet, to be a big fat pervert. Be sure to take a moment out of your hectic schedule and visit my stockroom today. You'll be so glad you did. Okay, on with the show. Welcome, Benjamin, and thank you for schlepping on over to DrDickSexAdvice.com.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so delighted that you are joining me for this Sex Wisdom podcast. I've been dying to have you on our show since the good folks over at Cleus Press introduced me to your latest book. So now that you're here, would you like to say hello to all the really nice people?
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for listening out there in listener land, wherever you might be, in your car, at the gym. God knows where you are, but thanks for having me on board and inside your head.
Good, good, good. And I know this is going to come as a bit of a shock, shrinking violent that you are and all, but I pretty much can guarantee that there will be a load of big, fat perverts in our audience, too. You want to say hello to them?
Those are exactly the types of perverts I like. I don't like ordinary perverts. I only like the big ones, the fat ones, the big fat ones, the ultimate
there
perverts.
There you go. And, you know, I have to include myself in that category because there you go. And they're my most loyal fans, don't you know?
Fantastic.
So, as I said, Cleus Press sent me a copy of your book, Geisha, Adventures in the Queer East, and from there I discovered your marvelous website, BenjaminLaw.com, and since then I've been hooked on all things Benjamin Law. You're quite the character, and you have such a way with words.
Well, thank you, Richard. That's very kind of you to say, especially coming from yourself, who similarly has a way with words. But this is my second book that I've ever written, but my first book that's been released in North America. So it's nice hearing from an international audience.
Yes, it is. It is. So I was going to ask you about this later, but since you introduced it, so Cleus is your American or North American publisher, yes?
That's right, that's right.
And your book was first published in India, as I recall?
My book was first, well, it was published in India, but first of all, it was published in Australia.
I see, good.
You might be able to tell by my accent, which is where I'm originally from. So if you meet me, you'll see a Chinese guy with Chinese face with a very Australian accent, because that happens to be the country where I live. It was the country where I was born. And so it was published in Australia in 2012.
Wow.
It was published in India in 2013, and it's just been published in North America North America, Canada, US in 2014 as well. So wow. It's had a sort of incremental release around the globe.
Wow, I love it. It's great.
Well, it's especially important for me for this book as well, because this is sort of a global book. I mean,
yes, it is true.
Specifically at Asia. But I guess it wasn't something that I thought about when I wrote the book, but there are two things that a lot of people around the world are interested in at the moment, and one is gay rights around the world,
yes.
And two is looking specifically at the region of Asia. It's this
yes.
economic powerhouse.
Yes,
the
true.
Fastest growing economies in the world are in Asia, and when you've got such fast growing economies like China, like India, the ones we talk about, but also say Mongolia, which unfortunately isn't a country I cover in my book, but when you've got some countries growing like that so quickly, of course economic changes are coupled with other changes as well. So hopefully what I wanted to present was a look at a book where culture is shifting really quickly,
yes.
and where LGBT consciousness is also shifting really
right.
quickly, or rubbing against traditional culture.
Right. And, you know, with an influx of economic security, other interests like sexuality and, you know, freedoms and stuff like that seem to flourish, and that can cause great panic in the eyes of the people who have traditionally held power.
Absolutely. Look, I don't think it's a really fashionable thing to talk about necessarily, but I think when, for instance, I went to India, I started realizing how much of modern gay consciousness is linked to a certain economic class. I think if
yes.
you're poorer, if you're a poorer Indian man, and there are all these expectations of you, social expectations, cultural and familial expectations, you're probably more likely to get traditionally married to a woman, live
yeah.
out your life as a married heterosexual man for all appearances,
yes.
and then have sex with men on the side. There isn't that privilege of actually identifying as a openly gay man. And when you go to India, a lot of those people who do, well, tend to be more economically privileged. So I think you've totally hit the nail on the head with that observation.
Right. So whenever I interview an author, I take some time before the interview to acquaint myself with the upcoming guest's work. And part of that is reading reviews of the author's works on Amazon and elsewhere. And what I discovered in the case of Geisha is most everyone loves your book. However, there were two negative reviews that made me laugh out loud. The first one was a one-star review that read, "I had to stop reading this book as I didn't like it because I felt the content should have been reported to the police."
Look, that might have been my mother who submitted that review, actually. I'm familiar with that review because I thought it was so hilarious.
Oh, my goodness.
That I actually show it out when I talk about my book in a public setting.
And rightfully so.
I think that's a great endorsement.
Oh, my goodness, yes. You couldn't pay for better advertising for this book. I'm telling you, it's great. So then there was this, two stars. Having heard the author interviewed on radio recently, I was sufficiently intrigued to find and read his book, expecting a lighthearted and informative insight into the gay Asian scene. However, it turned out to be a depressing litany of all the injustices visited upon the gay community in the third world countries. Fair enough. There's a lot of horror out there, but I don't necessarily want to read about it when I thought I had purchased a book about entertaining romp through gay Asia. Also irritating was the author's propensity to insert his left-leaning political ideology into almost every chapter. Not recommended.
You know, with a review like that, I almost have to nod at every juncture and say, you know what? I'm sorry that all of Asia isn't lighthearted for you enough.
Right.
Like, fair enough. If you were looking for that book, this isn't necessarily it. But
yes.
it's really funny, you know, reading that review, Richard, because of all the criticisms that have been lobbed against this book, they tend to be on both sides. Like, for instance, that person is saying this book is too depressing. And certainly I go, I mean, this book's fundamental concept is traveling to seven different Asian countries looking at seven different LGBT issues. And certainly some of those issues are pretty grim. There's no way to look at HIV/AIDS in Myanmar/Burma without getting grim. It's not a lighthearted topic. On the other hand, when this book came out in India, other people said it was too light. They wanted it to just be really serious. So a lot of academics started criticizing this book, saying that it was told with too light a touch.
Right.
And then other people have said, and this is my favorite, this is my favorite criticism of the book, that it's not smutty enough.
Oh.
That I promised on the blurb that I will get very naked, implying that there's going to be a lot of sex romps in this book. And then other people have said that it's too smutty.
You can't
please everyone.
Which means, to my mind, as a fellow author, that you've hit the nail right on the head, right there.
Oh, great!
And
so it's a perfect book.
It is. Sense. Well, you know, not it's absolutely perfect. Because I mean, if everybody's loving it, I mean, there's got to be something wrong. It seems to me, because you know, I'm guessing that this reviewer thought that one could romp through gay Asia and not trip over all the appalling injustices that gay, lesbian, bi, and trans folks on that continent experience on a daily basis. I mean, how can one do that?
Look, that was also one of the things I had in mind as I came into these countries, because if you do come into Asia as a Westerner, you tend to see these places as holiday hotspots.
Right, right.
And for instance, we start off in Indonesia in the island of Bali.
Yes.
And that's a growing sex tourism industry.
Yes.
And I imagine like a lot of people go there, you know, for sun, surf and sand, but also a bit of sex as well. And if that's the way you look at it, there we have to be aware that there's another dimension as well. So all of the chapters really are about an outsider's preconceptions. And that outsider is me, because even though I appear Asian, I've been raised in Australia all my life. So I am an outsider to these cultures.
Yes.
What are my preconceptions of them, and how are they challenged along the way?
So let me just ask right outright, are you some kind of lefty, pinko, commie, bleeding heart liberal? Because
if you are,
I'm so glad to have met you.
You know, there is a notorious conservative columnist here in Australia. I mean, you guys obviously...
Only one? Oh, yeah. That's too bad. We could send you a shitload from here.
I was about to say, you've got many equivalents. We've got many over here as well, but there's one particularly notorious one who has basically called me out as all of those things that you've just said.
Yes.
Pinko, lefto. I'm going to happily own up to all of those
good.
Things. I don't
good,
think
good,
they're
good.
Particularly bad, right?
Right. I totally agree. I absolutely. I wave that flag constantly, and happily so.
Mm.
So, Geisha reminded me so much of another such travelogue that was so pivotal in forming my gay identity and social consciousness way the fuck back when.
Mm.
Have you ever read States of Desire, Travels in Gay America by Edmund White? It was published back in the 1980s, so maybe not.
No, it's one of the Edmund White books that I haven't read, actually.
Oh, it really changed my perception about gay America back in the mm-hmm. 70s and early 80s. It's a fascinating read. It's still probably very, you know, timely.
And it's sort of, for the other people who haven't read it either, is it sort of a road trip through gay America in the early 80s,
yes,
or late
exactly.
70s, by
yes,
the sounds
exactly.
of
it. It is.
Mm.
And, you know, things are considerably different than they are now. I mean, like night and day almost. And in fact, I was writing a column not too long ago about, you know, and I was, you know, kind of reminiscing about the early days of the gay liberation, modern gay liberation movement here in the United States, and where it was, you know, was very, 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 very cutting edge to be a sexual outlaw, a gay man, for example. Nowadays, not so much. I mean, there's not so much cutting edge at all. In fact, it's kind of ho-hum, and, you know, I guess that's what comes from, you know, the inroads that we have made in, you know, in the popular culture and the acceptance of, you know, gay marriage and marriage equality and whatnot. But
I think you're right, Richard. I think there is that sense of mourning, isn't there?
Yes.
That you used to be a fringe, you know, a community living
yes.
on the fringes.
Yes.
And that gives you strength in community as
That's
well.
Right.
I mean, when you come out as a gay man in an era when it was still illegal, like in my home state of Queensland in Australia, homosexuality was still illegal right up until the year 1990. So that's well within my
wow.
lifetime. And talking to people who grew up in the Sunshine State, as we call it, in that period, there is that sense of really strong banding around, because if you came out as a gay man, as a gay woman during that period, you would have been rejected from your loved ones,
yes.
your friends
yes.
and family,
yes.
and therefore
yes.
you become this renegade other family with
yes.
your fellow queers.
Yes.
And as time goes on, you know, that mainstream sort of yearning for acceptance also comes with losing that part of history, that dynamic,
it's
that
true.
Sort of that nice friction between
yes.
between you as an outsider and everyone else.
Right. Your book takes us through a lot of the South and Southeast Asia, Thailand, Indonesia, Japan,
mm-hmm.
Burma, China, Malaysia, and India. First of all, how long did your research take you?
I was ducking in and out of Asia over the course of 2 years.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the equivalent time that I probably would have spent in Asia in total was close to a year in and out of these countries. If I had greater resilience, I probably would have done them all in one hit. If I didn't have a partner back home, I probably would have done it in one hit as well.
Uh-huh.
But coming back to Australia also gave me the opportunity to reflect on what
right.
I'd seen.
Right,
I think
right,
when
right.
you immerse yourself in a completely different environment, you know, half of these countries were countries I'd never visited before, and you tend to lose perspective as to what you think is acceptable or what you think
yes.
is normal, and coming back to Australia helped me get my bearings. But I definitely, in China I spent 2 months, and in the other countries I tried to spend at least a good month, and a month before doing a lot of research and interviews before I went over.
Hmm. Since these countries have a rich, ancient, and varied culture, each has its own peculiarities and quirks as they deal with the sexual minorities in their midst, right?
Absolutely, and I think a lot of that in different countries has to do with the dominant religion there.
Right,
I mean,
right, right.
Malaysia, a dominant Muslim majority country, is going to be very different to Thailand, which is, you know, a Buddhist majority country,
mm-hmm.
which is going to be very different again from Japan and China, who don't really have a dominant especially a
right.
dominant monotheistic religion at all to follow. So all these attitudes are quite different. And what that brings up, I mean, often the question I'm asked is, which country's best at gay rights?
Mm-hmm.
Or which country's worst at gay rights? And you can sort of roughly say, well, look, you wouldn't want to be a young gay guy in Myanmar where your chances of getting HIV are, you know, something like 5 times more than the rest of the general population. But at the same time, maybe, in China, you would say, look, homophobia as we know it in the West doesn't really exist in China. There's not an overt hatred for gay people. But if you've got a society like China where filial piety
right.
and family responsibilities are really, really at the center of all lives, maybe the other problem is that there's no discussion about it and you don't
yes.
actually even have a vocabulary for what's going on
right.
in your brain.
Right.
You know, that's a whole other problem that maybe in the West we don't have. So it's hard to say this one's better, this one's different, but certainly, religion just does play a central force in all of that.
All right. And it's interesting, I mean, I know very little of this, and your book was very helpful to me in just trying to get a big picture in my head. But it seems to me that there are, like here in the United States too, I mean, men who are outwardly, and boys who are outwardly effeminate,
mm.
and who, you know, kind of live in that that strange border place between masculine and feminine, they have a different kind of thing than a very masculine man, you know, who may want to identify as gay. And cultures deal very different with them.
Yeah, absolutely. And going to a place like Burma, for instance, or Myanmar, that was a huge eye-opening experience, because their gender and sexuality categories amongst what we'd call the queer community of the cities is very much divided even further. I mean, those concepts of, you know, cisgendered male, for instance, Richard, you know, like guys who present as masculine but
yes.
happen to be gay. That's probably an emerging consciousness within the queer world in the West. But over in Myanmar, they have specific terms. Like, for instance, a print will be a certain type of gay man who will always present as feminine. In Thailand, for instance, you've always had the term katui, which is probably roughly translated into transgender male in the West as well. So in many Asian countries, there's always been distinctions that that we're not as, I don't know, that we might not have the exact sort of vocabulary to talk about in the West.
Wow. Could I prevail upon you to read from your book?
Sure.
Oh, yay.
Now, there are many, many different places I could read from, but I might start at the start. You know, this book, Geisha, that I've written has 7 different chapters, and people have told me they've noticed that it gets darker as the chapters go along. So I might read at the start where it starts off lightly. I start off in Indonesia on the tourist island of Bali, which, you know, tourism accounts for most of the economic engine of that island. And I start off at a gay nudist resort.
Cool.
It's called Spartacus. And Spartacus is spelt with a V instead of a U because it's more edgy. At this time of day, Spartacus became an ecosystem worthy of an Attenborough documentary. Back when it first opened, Spartacus had a problem with local money boys loitering outside its doors for business, but they'd solved that by allowing a few in at a time to hang around the pool, order drinks, and use the Wi-Fi. Policy was strict. Money boys weren't allowed to approach guests, but guests could approach the money boys if they wanted to chat and take them into their rooms without fuss. On this day, there were only a couple of men trading themselves. One money boy was less boy and more like a tank. He was rugged with tightly coiled muscles covered in barbed tattoos. Another money boy was clean cut in preppy white shorts, looking like a Tommy Hilfiger advertisement with his hair cut short at the back and sides. They were the only clothed men around the pool besides me. Because they weren't allowed to talk, they ogled and seduced with their eyes, zoning in on the naked boule, white men, Spartacus guests, with silent, intense stares. As I ate my sandwich, I watched one of the boules approach the money boys. He was an Australian man in his 50s with a kind face and a soft belly who wore black speedos with an opal pattern on the hip. The tattooed guy grinned and made staggered small talk with the boule before the pair silently headed back to a private room, drawing the black satin curtains shut. Everyone else around the pool casually pretended that nothing was happening. I stared and chewed on my lunch, cow-like, unable to turn away. This place is amazing, I thought. Another Australian man, white and in his late 30s, now approached the pool completely naked. He was one of the younger boules here, tall and toned, and it was hard not to notice his penis, an enormous semi-erect thing that hovered in midair like a fairground ride threatening to go higher. Behind him, his short, cute Indonesian boyfriend, or maybe he was a money boy too, it was hard to tell, approached the pool in high-cut running shorts that made him appear practically naked from the side. Giggling, they dived in the pool together. As they surfaced for air, the naked Australian guy swam over to his boyfriend and wrapped his legs around him, making out with him hungrily, like a large animal trying to eat a smaller creature's face. It felt as if I'd stumbled across some wonderful sex matinee. It was riveting. This was the closest I'd ever come to watching another couple have sex right in front of me, and the realization was both exciting and vaguely depressing. Though he was in the water, it was clear the Australian guy had a full erection now and was enthusiastically humping his Indonesian boyfriend through his wet shorts. After making kissing noises that sounded like a draining sink, the Indonesian guy climbed onto his boyfriend's back, and they swam across the pool like the scene in Whale Rider, where Keisha Castle Hughes rides a humpback whale. You two are so cute, I wanted to call out to them, but realised this might send the wrong message. When they got out of the pool and towed each other off, the height difference between them was stark. From behind, the tall boule reminded me of a parent drying off his young son after swimming lessons. The two of them then disappeared into their room, drew the curtains, and shut the door. The entire pool was now silent, except for the PA system that was playing the Joe Dolce 1980 hit novelty song Shut Up Your Face. I had finished my lunch. I felt both full of food and moderately aroused, which wasn't a great combination, and I stared at the empty water, wondering whether I should bring myself to swim in it, considering what I'd just seen. That's from Geisha, the Indonesia chapter.
Wow. That's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. I mean, your editorial is comments are brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Thanks, Richard.
So these contradictions that we've been speaking about, they abound. This is a world where two men cannot love each other, but there's plenty of men having sex with men, and really vibrant male sex trade, right?
Well, absolutely. And when I talked about going into these countries, being full aware of my preconceptions of what I'd find, like, for instance, I was always going to be in Bali looking at the sex tourism trade there, and coming in as someone from the West, coming in from someone who's Australian, you assume, and to an extent rightly so, that there's going to be a huge power imbalance between the people who are paying and the people who are paid, and that there will be a level of exploitation. Mm-hmm. And what, of course, I was surprised by is that, you know, exploitation can go both ways often.
Yes, oh, absolutely.
And in the Indonesian, or specifically the Balinese gay sex trade, I would interview a lot of these money boys later in the chapter, and I spent a night with one over dinner, and we were just having a big talk, and I said, well, tell me about your life. Like, you economically sound okay. You've got a daytime job. It's not like you need to have paid sex to supplement your income hugely in order to get by. Why do you do it? And he looked at me and he scoffed and he said, oh, come on. Like, I'm young. I'm hot. I'm not going to be young and hot forever.
Wow.
If I'm going to have sex with men, they better pay me for it. I have self-respect. And
I love
something like that completely topples right. your expectations of what sex work might involve.
Right.
And on a very fundamental level, when someone challenges you with that, you think, I sort of get you. That sort of does make sense.
Right.
Why aren't I selling myself for sex? You know. And of course, that's only one particular story, but it was a story that came up again and again. Whereas, you know, a country like Burma, that's a very different case with sex work, because Burma is such a poor country. When I was writing this book, the CIA in a survey estimated that Burma's gross domestic profit per capita, which is a rough indicator of living standards, was somewhere between North Korea's and Afghanistan's.
Oh my.
So that's an incredibly poor country, and therefore sex work in that country, Burma/Myanmar, often comes from a place of desperation.
Yes.
That you really don't have a choice. You might have been taken away forcibly from your hometown. You don't know how to get back. You're in a big city like Yangon. You see other people selling themselves for sex. You start doing it as well. And on a bad night, you might charge roughly the equivalent of 65 US cents per hour.
Wow.
So that's a whole different dynamic over there.
Yes, goodness. And there's always a double standard that exists between the rights of men and women. And this is much more pronounced than it is in the Western world, as I guess.
Yeah, in the sex trade particularly?
Well, you know, in terms of what is possible for, let's say, a gay man or as opposed to a lesbian.
Mm. You mean in terms of, like, social expectations?
Yes,
of,
and,
of
you know, just like the male privilege that obviously, as we talked about just moments ago, cuts both ways, a male might have more freedoms, but he also has the responsibility of, you know, being the head of a family at some point in his life. Can women get away without being married?
It really depends, you know, and you are right in pointing out that there is a double standard. Like, let's always remember that within LGBTIQ even, that it's a really broad sort of acronym to describe a whole bunch of different communities and people. And within that minority group, there are minorities within minorities. And of course, women's voices are often shouted out of that.
Yes.
Even if they do have a big lesbian consciousness, they have different expectations of them as well. Now, your question about whether you can sort of escape getting married, it really depends. Like in China, for instance, that sort of sense of filial piety in order to marry, that extends to both men and women.
I see.
So by the age of, say, your early 30s in mainland China, if you're not yet married, that's seen as a really strange thing. It's sort of seen almost as if you're not human, and not even seen by other people, but also yourself as well.
Right.
So in
because you internalize all that.
Absolutely. You expect yourself to be married by that age. And it was really interesting in China, which was a country where I was originally going to look at how young queer people connected online in a country where being online is fundamentally strange. One of the ways that people were connecting online was young gay men and young gay women were looking for each other.
Oh, how interesting.
Fake marry. They would hold these elaborately staged fake marriages in order to show their parents that yes, they were doing the right thing, and then they might go on in their private lives to lead their, you know, their gay lives. So that pressure is definitely there, and I think what's interesting is there is often more at stake if you are a woman as well, especially if you're in a country where women just hold less economic power.
Right.
It might be harder for you to get a job. There is more at stake if you start asserting your identity and if you're uncovered to be a lesbian. Like, for instance, one of the chapters I really wanted to write for this book, but it was difficult to write because I was a man and I needed to access the women's voices, was the whole, in Muslim-majority countries where women lead very dual lives. They lead separate lives. One, which is very openly gay with their friends, and two, which is very, very conservative with their family.
Right.
As well. But of course they wouldn't want to necessarily talk to me because I'm a guy and they've got a lot to lose. Right. In that situation.
Right. I'm looking at my clock and our time is up for today. In fact, we're over time. Any possibility I could seduce you into coming back and chatting more with us next week?
I would love nothing more. That's the invitation.
Yay. Alrighty then. Before we go, would you give us your website address? Walk us around a little bit. Tell us where we can buy your book.
Sure. So if you want to find out more about me and where to buy my book, you can go to my website, which is benjamin-law.com. So it's benjamin-law.com. If you want to find out more about Geisha and its American release, go to my publisher's website, Cleis Press, which is cleispress.com, CLEISPress.com.
Good. I'll have links in today's podcast posting for our listeners' convenience. You're on Twitter, I know. Are you Facebook?
I am just on Twitter as Mr. Benjamin Law, not so much on Facebook. It's
okay.
More personal account.
Yes. All right, kiddo.
I should probably get around to that.
You better. Anyhow, I hate Facebook, but it's a necessary evil.
Sure.
Authors. Anyhow, till next week, we'll be seeing you in cyberspace.
Great. Thanks, Richard.
Thanks. Bye. What a terrific show. Well, that's it for today, Sex fans. Tune in next week at this same time for part two of my chat with Benjamin Law and more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's Stockroom. Listen up, you guys. If your sex life needs a little sprucing up, and whose doesn't, I want you to mosey on over to my online sex emporium and pick out something really naughty for yourself, or one of the other pervs in your life. I mean, if you can't find what you're looking for in my stockroom, you'd better just call the search off right now. Dr. Dick has put together a dazzling array of products that will liven up even the most ho-hum sex life. Not sure what to buy? Take a look at my sex toy reviews site, drdicksextoyreviews.com. It's chock full of swell gift-giving ideas. And look for Dr. Dick's Stockroom banner in the sidebar of my site. And remember, a portion of every sale comes back to us as support for these shows. How great is that? Okay, until next week, remember, sex is good. And good sex? Well, that's even better. Over and out.